Hey, everybody, it's Stu Smith with another Two Through and After series, and we got a special guest, Eddie Gallagher here, former Navy SEAL. Eddie, thank you so much for coming on and being a part of this journey where we learn a little bit more about you.
I appreciate that. Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's an honor. And like I sent you an email. I can't believe I'm talking to you. I pretty much did your books when I was 19 until I went to Buds, and it's you were like the first Navy SEAL I ever saw, I think.
You know, that means a lot, because I can remember the first Navy SEAL I met. And, yeah. You know, I still tell him today, you know, he's a mentor in the area now. And I always bump into him and just share that. He's the first SEAL I ever met. So, yeah, that's cool. Well, thank you for that. I appreciate that. But I think everybody has heard of Eddie Gallagher and your story. But you know, what I would really want to do is focus on your journey, right? Let's talk about Eddie Gallagher, starting off young kid. Where'd you grow up and what made you want to, you know, go into the military?
Sure. So I was born in New Jersey, Patterson. My dad was in the Army, West Point grad. So growing up, I was a, you know, mod one Army brat, moved around every 2 years, mostly grew up in Asia, in military bases. So it was definitely a unique childhood, you know, just living on all the military Army bases that I did. I was pretty much, you know, raised in the military around it. I didn't know anything different. I was used to just, you know, seeing guys in uniform all the time, you know, around the base. I was one of those kids, you know, when colors played, it was, you stopped whatever you're doing and, you know, face the flag. I think it was, my dad stayed in until I hit high school. And that's when he didn't want to get out. I think it was Clinton was president at the time. They did cutbacks and he was sort of forced out. He retired as a lieutenant colonel. And we ended up back in Springfield, Virginia, right outside of D.C. And from there, he was trying to figure out what he was going to do next, job-wise. And we ended up in Fort Wayne, Indiana, moving there. He ended up working for Talus, who makes the embitters that we use. But it was definitely, that was a huge transition. Even that, I'm not, early stages of my life, like going from being around the military constantly and then all of a sudden ending up in, you know, Fort Wayne, Indiana, which, you know, there's pretty much no military around there. I went to Catholic high school there. Wasn't a very good student. I definitely had, a lot of trouble paying attention in high school. I was always, you know, getting into mischief and just didn't have the focus that I needed. But, you know, I somehow made it through, got my diploma. And from there, I had no real aspirations of joining the military at first. It just wasn't something that crossed my mind, even though I had grown up in it. So I gave, you know, I gave college a try. I went to community college for about half a semester, realized that wasn't for me. And then sort of just worked odd jobs around, you know, Fort Wayne where I lived. And then just, thank God, came the realization that I needed to get out of there. And I drove to the recruiting station one morning on my own and went in to the first recruiting office, which was the Navy. And I was probably a recruiter's wet dream. Just, I was like, I want out of here. I'll do whatever. He pretty much jumped up out of his desk and was like getting the paperwork ready. And I knew that when I went there to the recruiting office, I knew I wanted to do something, you know, that was going to be hard. I wanted to, you know, train for war, you know, in my mind, I want to be a badass, you know, like I wanted all the movies I grew up watching, especially Navy SEALs, Rambo, Commando, all that. That was like my vision of, what I wanted to be, but I really had no idea of what that would entail. I just sort of dove right in. I was like, I want to be a SEAL. Oh. The recruiter, of course, was like, oh yeah, no problem. You'll just go to boot camp and then tell them you want to be a SEAL there. So I went in with no contract, no nothing.
First of all, what year was this?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, this was 1999.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. Pre-9/11. So it was a different world back then, and a different process to get into the Navy as well.
Yeah. So I know nowadays they have, you know, the SEAL contracts. There's like a pipeline. You pretty much go to boot camp to the Great Lakes program and then off to BUDS. Back then it was very difficult to get in, especially if you didn't, you know, I picked corpsman as a rate. When I got to boot camp, I was told they were overmanned in corpsman. So I would not be able to go to BUDS right away. So I went, you know, I went to corps school after boot camp, and I was pretty frustrated because, you know, they weren't going to let me go to BUDS. But so I looked into my other options. And of course, you know, you could go to the Marines as a corpsman. So that was my my next choice. I was like, that's what I want to do. I had no intent on going to a ship or working in a hospital. And I had talked, luckily I had some good instructors there that, you know, they told me I could try out for recon, and that would be just like, you know, the job that I had envisioned doing as a SEAL. So went through corps school, ended up in Camp Lejeune in North Carolina, went to field med school, which is pretty much a course that gets you ready to be with the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's almost like a mini little Marine boot camp.
Yeah, they call that kind of like going to the green side.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Get you ready to go to the green side. Learn all of their traditions and their, you know, regulations, everything like that. And so from there, I took these reconnaissance corpsmen came in and were like, hey, if you guys want to come over, here's the screener. You guys can take it tomorrow. I think there was myself and about two other guys that took it. And that was a real, you know, kick in the ball screener. It was the Marine Corps PRT, an 8-mile ruck run, the whole thing, you know, swimming in the pool with camis, 500 meter swim.
Yeah, that sucks too, man.
Yeah, it was an eye opener, and luckily, I mean, I made it, you know, I passed. And so I thought that's where I was going to be going. And, you know, I was very young at the time, didn't know what I was doing. Some Marines from 1st Battalion, 8th Marines came in and said, hey, we need corpsmen over here. And they literally just pointed out to the room, you're going. They pointed at me. I was like, okay. And didn't ask any questions, just went over to 1-8. And, you know, if I was a little mature, I would have been like, no, this is not the route I want to go. But I was just following orders at the time.
Sure.
But, you know, it all worked out. It all happened for a reason. I love my time at 1-8. I got assigned to a grunt platoon my first deployment. That was pre-9/11. We ended up going over to take part, and Kosovo was just winding down, or it was coming to an end. But we got to go take part in the last bit of that. Nothing too crazy, but it was kind of cool to be part of like a real world thing at the time. And from there, I knew that the grunt battalion is not where I wanted to be, but I had to serve 2 more years with the Marines before I could actually go to BUDS. So I was going to go recon again. And I went over there to take the screener, and thankfully one reconnaissance Marine had asked me like, why do you want to come over here? And I said, you know, I want to be a SEAL, but this is, you know, next best route I think I could take. And he said, don't come over here then. If that's what you want to do, then do not come over here. You will be stuck here. And it'll be harder to go to BUDS if you come over here. So I looked into what the next best thing I could do. And there was a stay platoon, which is, it's a sniper platoon that's assigned to each battalion. And that was about a month long screener to even get into that platoon. And they were looking for a corpsman because they had just lost theirs. So when I got back from that deployment, I took the month long screener. And made it into the platoon. And that was probably one of the best experiences that my best choices I made. Those guys were the most professional, bunch of guys that I could ever ask to be around. They were phenomenal at their job. They were all about training, practicing their craft every day. So I just immersed myself into that. the guys ended up really liking me, and they somehow got me a slot to Marine Corps Scout Sniper School. The deal was that I would be able to go through sniper school, but I would not get the credit for it because I was not a Marine. But I was like, that sounds like, I was just grateful to be able to attend.
Good way to learn.
Yeah. And I figured it would, better prepare me for when I went to BUDS. So I got to go to Marine Corps Sniper School, ended up graduating. 9/11 had kicked off at the time. So it was definitely a very chaotic time. During that, we were, I remember when 9/11 kicked off, we were on the rifle range, and it was just like that. It was like chaos. Everyone had to go back to the barracks, pack your sea bags, we're going to war. And then we sat in our sea bags for I don't know how many months waiting. We ended up deploying. 1-8 went into Mosul it was the first ones to go into Mosul. Not very, there wasn't a lot that happened there, but it was a different time. Back then during the first initial invasion, confusing. I think from, higher ups down, everybody was sort of confused on what to do. It was sort of just this new open terrain, and but it was good. It was a good sort of start to what I thought that I wanted to do. When I came back from that deployment, I took the screener for BUDS. It was like my 10th time taking it, and they finally were like, all right, you can go. And that came down to one chief that checked into 1-8. He saw my record and saw I had taken the screener 10 times, and was like, why isn't this guy, have orders? And they were like, well, we need corpsman here. And he was like, nope. And he marched me down to admin and got me orders right there. And, thank God that I got news a couple months ago that he passed. But, without him, I would have never made it to where I was or where I am now. Got orders to BUDS around 2004 and drove across country, checked in and started off BUDS with class 251.
Okay. What year was that?
That was in 2004.
Okay, so it sounds like you pretty much grew up with the Navy and the Marine Corps. You obviously did a lot there, basically going from a boy to a man, that age from 18, 19 to 22, 23 is night and day, as you know. What were some of the things that you were able to do to just better prepare yourself for what you were about to, what you've been training for years?
So I always tell people, I get asked all the time, what did you do to prepare for BUDS, or what are certain things, the mindset and everything. I felt like I was the path that I was sort of forced into or took going into the Marine Corps was a huge blessing, because once I decided to make the decision that I wanted to be a SEAL, it was like a switch went off, and I became obsessed with everything SEAL. I went out and purchased the 12 weeks to BUDS workout. I think I ran through that book 20 times over, just kept doing it. Nothing else mattered to me at that time than making it to BUDS. I lived and breathed. Even the Marines I was with were like, you're psychotic, because I would get up at, 4 in the morning, run, swim. And I would probably work out, 2-3 times a day if I could, because in my mind, I was building BUDS up like this impossible thing where it's like, we're just going to constantly be getting beat down. And I'm glad I had that mindset, because I stayed with that for the 4 years I was with the Marines. When I finally got to BUDS, I was prepared. I was physically prepared. My time with the Marines, going through Marine Sniper School, I was mentally prepared. I knew I had a very good idea of what I was getting into which was sort of an eye opener when I showed up to BUDS. There's a lot of guys were coming straight from boot camp. Some guys, were coming from the fleet, and I could tell by talking to them, they didn't really know what they were getting into or how it worked. So I felt like I had sort of an upper hand. I was more seasoned than a lot of students that showed up. Then the big thing was I had been on a combat deployment already, which was didn't go over too well with some of the instructors when we had dress blues inspection. They just busted my chops the whole time about it and got, you know, I got wet, but it was Buds was one of the best times that I never want to have again. You know, it's
I would agree with that. This is something you let's never do this again, but it was fun while you were there.
Exactly. Because it had taken me so long to get there, I was just grateful every day that I was there. I mean, I still remember driving across the Coronado Bridge to go check into Buds and just being like so excited that like I made it, you know. So I had that mindset going into like, I'm gonna pass this. Like, I'm not gonna quit. You know? I knew I was like, if I quit, that means I'm dead. Like, that's the only way I'm gonna, you know, not make it. Not to say that it wasn't hard. Buds was definitely difficult. I think, you know, Buds is so unique compared to other selection courses, to where I think like no matter who you are, you can go there and be either, you know, Division I athlete or you know, a wrestler or a runner. You're gonna find something that you're not good at there. It's just, you know, you can't prepare for everything that comes at you in Buds, which I think that makes it super unique, because you're there with some studs. I mean, I remember looking at guys in the class when we formed up, and I was like, what am I, like, maybe I'm not prepared, because there were some guys that, you know, look like monsters, but then once it starts, you see those guys go away, and it's a very unique selection course. I had a blast. I made lifelong friends, with my roommates, which we're still, you know, really close to this day. I think the trouble I had, I got rolled in second phase, for pool comp. Had a little trouble with the tabs. They had to be 4 finger length. Mine, for some reason, kept being 3 or over. I ended up getting rolled, getting put into 2.52, and then had no issues after that. Got through Buds.
Real quick, when did you realize when you were going through Buds that, like, I got this? Right? Not that you ever really had any doubts. Maybe you did, but when was it like that moment that was just like, you know what? I'm prepared for this. I'm ready.
I think I had that added, like, from the moment we started doing the timed evolutions and then just, you know, the everyday evolutions. Like, I had no issues with doing any of that. I was, like I said, I was happy to be there. I was grateful I was there. So I had a good mindset. I was like, I never once, you know, felt sorry for myself or felt like, oh, this is too much, or I'm in pain. Like, I was like, this is exactly where I need to be. But as far as, I never really thought that it never crossed my mind that, like, oh, I have this, until the day that we graduated, because I think that's a good attitude to have. Like, you should never get complacent. I mean, even the last day at third phase, you're still locked on. Like, it's not until I get that trident on my chest where and even then, I don't even think you should act like, well, I've made it.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I misphrased that, but what I would say is, I remember, you know, all the anxiety that I had of starting Buds. And then I realized I actually prepared for this, especially when I saw people on my left and people on my right, they were quitting. And I was thinking, man, it hadn't gotten hard yet. What's going on? You know, so I think that's
very true. Yeah, that I definitely knew that in first base. I figured that out when guys were failing the runs or the oak courses and the swims. Mm-hmm. You know, you're like, well, in my mind, I'm like, what did you think this was entailed? You know, like, it's, and back then, I mean, back then there wasn't a lot of information on Buds. I think the one book, The Warrior Elite, is the book I read, the Dick Couch book.
Mm-hmm.
Read that 100 times, you know.
Great, great series of books he has. Yeah. They're really good.
Yeah. Definitely. So that was, at least I read that book and I knew what the timed, you know, evolutions entailed. And I tried to do as much research as possible before I went. So I definitely felt, you know, I'd be prepared when I went there. But I kept the attitude, you know, I could go away at any time. It's, you know, it's a selection.
Yeah. That's a good point. You definitely had to bring your A game every day.
Yeah.
You know, even though you're like, all right, maybe the anxiety is a little bit less because you wondered if you belong there or not. But I got you. All right. So let's do this. Let's shift forward a little bit. You've gotten through Buds. You've gotten through SQT. Let's talk about some of your, you know, as a new guy in the teams. How was that for you?
It was amazing. I had a very, I checked into team one, Delta Platoon, and I had just some amazing senior guys that, you know, when I checked in, it was a little bit different for me when I checked in. They saw that I had been in for, you know, at that point, 5 years. I had been over to Iraq already, which, you know, the war was hot and heavy at the time. A lot of those guys had not been yet. So I think I got looked at a little bit differently, like, okay, this guy has a little bit more experience, but I still, you know, remained the new guy, just, you know, eyes open, ears open, just listening, trying to take everything in. My first platoon, we ended up going to hit Iraq, which was a good, great deployment, very kinetic. But the workup up to that deployment, I struggled a little bit. I went to 18 Delta right after SQT. So I got my Trident, went to medical school, the SOC, Special Operations Medical School, mm-hmm. Which was definitely probably the hardest thing I've done. You're drinking through a fire hose and just trying to pass tests every day. And studying was not my strong suit, but while I was there, I like transformed, you know, the way I thought and the way I attacked studying and reading. I just, again, immersed myself in it because I was scared of failing. So when I got to a team, I was a little out of my element when it came to tactics and, you know, shooting, because, you know, I hadn't been doing that in 8 months. And when I checked in, we went right into workup. I think I was there about 3 days, and then we were off to a CQB block, and I was definitely playing catch up. It was that block was a nightmare for me, because I was trying to, you know, the rest of the guys had been training for that block. Everybody was sort of synced up already, and I was sort of trying to fit, you know, find my way in, but it ended up working out. I had great older guys who, instead of hammering me because I was messing up, they would take the time to, you know, hey, this is how it's done. Show me the ropes, which I was completely grateful for. But then, yeah, we ended up going to hit Iraq. Did a 7-month deployment there, then came back and stayed at team one, same platoon. And we ended up going to do another workup, which went 1,000 times better than my first one. I felt a lot more comfortable. I was like, okay, that's when I started. Okay, I sort of belong. I belong here. I know what's going on. And we ended up going to Afghanistan, that deployment. That deployment was an eye opener for sure. Just on a combat deployment level. Our OIC, Dan Knossen, lost his legs the very first op, which was, you know, definitely like, okay, this is real. That deployment, it just went on like that from there. It was very, very kinetic. Lots just going out, getting in lots of ticks. But it was fun. I mean, that's the job that we signed up for, everyone. And I had a great crew with me. You know, we ended up losing our platoon chief that deployment. He got injured and got sent home. And I think the group of guys that I was with during that time were so confident. And I think most of us were on our second platoon or third platoon, but they were like, well, these guys, really do they need a platoon chief or not? Like, they're still operating, you know?
Damn. And,
it was different, but they ended up putting in a guy named Johnny Heil, slotted him into our platoon, and we continued operating. That deployment lasted about 7 months. I ended up staying an extra 3 weeks. I got tasked to go to Sangin province to work with the Brits doing some counter sniper operations. And that's where I got to be with the Marines up in Sangin for a little bit and saw like exactly what they were going through, which was super hellacious. They were just losing guys every day. There's tons of IEDs. And I think that's the first time I really saw like the atrocities of war or whatever. And that just, it sort of fed my drive to want to keep going back. I was like, this, you know, I had it in my mind. I was like, this war is going to be ongoing and we need to just keep going back that we're going to win. So I came back from that deployment and I wanted to do another platoon, but got tasked over to first base as an instructor. Was sort of told, hey, you need to go take a break or go do this. And I fought it, but honestly, that was probably one of the best duty stations I had. Being a first phase instructor is, you know, it was tough as far as schedule wise and being busy. We were short on instructors at the time and we were short on instructors. And at that time they were trying to grow the force. We were doing 7, 7, and 7, which was 7 classes a year.
Huge classes.
Huge.
First phase saw what? 300 person classes at that time?
Yes. Yeah. Whew. It was an eye opener for sure. You know, as an instructor coming in, and then you have to learn the difference between mentoring these guys, but at the same time, you know, sort of being the hammer, like you have to earn your spot here. That definitely helped me grow when I was there. Because I came in to that first phase, like, oh, let's just hammer time. Like, this is the way I remember it when I came through. But once you see behind the curtain, when you're there, you're like, okay, yes, our job is to hammer them, but also to mentor these kids, you know, as they come through. And I think that happens obviously after Hell Week. You're like, okay, these are the group of individuals that need to be taught. We're going to be working with them someday. Yeah. And a big thing I did when I was there is just lead by example. I would do all the, you know, as many evolutions as I could with the students. When I proctored, I did every timed evolution with them. Just because I felt that, you know, the students would respect that a lot more. Like, okay, this is what a SEAL is supposed to be or look like or do, you know. It was just an overall great experience. And then even to this day, I still, you know, I run into guys like, oh, you're my first phase instructor, you know, and I really look up to you the way you were. And that means a lot more than, you know, however many combat deployments or whatever you've been on. I'm like, that there, at least I made a difference, you know, in the community.
That is something that I always enjoyed. Like, I knew there was someone that I had to keep up with, when I was a student. You know, there's someone doing all the reps with you, someone doing the running with you. You know, it was just, you know, it was something that, you know, you really worked hard to be in that same room with them, you know, and I think that is something that's unique about that school for sure.
Exactly. And then, you know, as a first phase student, you know, the instructors, first phase instructors, those are really like the first SEALs that you see. So you were like, these are what I want to be like. So if you, you know, if you're an instructor that shows up and is sort of blase and just like, I don't really want to be, I mean, these kids are, they're watching you and they're like, okay. And they're going to remember you and they're going to remember your attitude, you know? So, it was a very good spot to be in. But while I was there, I wanted to go to, development group. So I screened out of there, went to green team, ended up getting cut near the end of CQC, which was a big blow. I was definitely disappointed. All my friends were at the time had already screened and were over there or were planning on screening. But again, it was a blessing in disguise. I had, you know, I came back from green team, tried to screen again right away. I wanted to come back the next class. They had told me to wait. You know, they're like, you can't come back. You have to wait, give it another year, and you'll come back class after. Just, you know, sit at a training command. I was like, no, I don't want to sit at you. I want to go work. So I ended up bouncing over to Team 7, who was taken off to Afghanistan again. Did like, you know, a half a workup with them or almost a full workup and deployed with them over there. But because I felt my confidence had that sort of skyrocketed just from being, even though I got dropped from green team, my confidence level was definitely different. I showed up, I, I started taking control and you know, helping other guys out. And I really like, I think flourished as a leader.
Do you think being a Buds instructor also helped you with that transition?
Yeah, it was, and that's also a funny thing is checking into a team after being a Buds instructor, seeing the guys that you had put through, and there's that awkward, like none of them want to, you know, talk to you and they won't look at you. But then once you talk to them, like, hey, I'm actually a pretty chill, cool guy. And they're like, I was an instructor, you know, playing the role. But yeah, it's funny to see just the impact you have on those guys. But yeah, that definitely helped. It helped with me trying to lead as well. Cause guys were willing to follow. Cause you lead by example, they're like, okay, well, he's doing it, then I'll do it. So after that deployment, that's when I picked up an LPO position, at Team 7. And, my goal was to still go over to Dev Group. I was like, I still want to screen. The Master Chief at the time had told me, you know, just do the LPO and then screen after that. So I did another platoon, ended up going to the Cree, which is in UAE, Dubai. Very boring deployment, just a lot of sitting around. I think that was probably the hardest deployment I had.
Was that mostly like bilateral training with some allies in the region?
Yeah, there's a lot of that over there. The problem was we were supposed to deploy to Yemen, and Yemen had shut down a week before we deployed. So they had no place for us to go. So they sort of stuck us in Dubai, but we weren't even supposed to be there. So we were just sort of some strap hangers trying to figure out work. But, you know, while I was there, it took about a couple months of sitting around not doing, you know, trying to figure out not doing anything. And then we started up a training cell to start teaching the guys that were there CQC, and we're not teaching, but getting them better at their craft. So, you know, the next platoon, they would, you know, whatever platoon they were going to, they would crush it and know their job a lot better, which that fulfilled me. I really did like teaching them and also myself, like I was still learning a lot. So spent that whole deployment just training. And from, I picked up Chief on that deployment, got selected, came back, and I was offered a platoon chief spot right away. The Master Chief's like, hey, we want you to stay. That was a huge crossroads for me, because I still wanted to go over to the command. And I called my buddies over there, and they told me to take the platoon chief spot. At that point, I was pretty hot, long in the tooth for my rank. I think I was at 17 years and just picked up chief. So they were like, it's better off that you do your platoon chief there and just continue the course. So I made that decision, stayed, became platoon chief, got sent over to an alpha platoon, and ended up doing that platoon. At the time, there was not a lot going on as far as combat wise for the military teams. We were still over in Iraq and Afghanistan, but there wasn't a lot of authority to do anything at the time. But I knew that Mosul was going to kick off. I had a buddy over there, and so that was the goal, was to get my platoon over there. So I came into that platoon pretty hot and heavy, as far as like, this is what we're doing. I know I laid out my expectations, and we did nothing but train the whole time. And we ended up getting the best platoon of the team, or ranked number one, and got to go where we wanted, which was awesome. And that deployment at in Mosul was definitely one of the more memorable ones. Not because of all the stuff that it's, you know, followed afterwards, but it was a very I'd never seen anything like it. And all my deployments, we were sort of tasked with partnering with Iraqi forces and being behind them and watching them clear Mosul, but it was more lay siege. ISIS had built up that city for the past, I don't know how many years. They were prepared. And it's like a medieval, just watching this medieval war take place, where Americans are sort of stepping in when they need to or not. So it was definitely an experience, which I was glad to have. you know, again, I was happy to be there. It's what I wanted. And then we finished up that deployment, cleared Mosul, and, you know, came back, got ranked number one chief at the platoon. We worked for a MARSOC. We fell under MARSOC at the time, in which it was a small world. The Lieutenant Colonel Christian was the CEO of MARSOC. I actually worked for him when I was at 1-8. So we had a good relationship right off the bat. We remembered each other. So it was a very, very good deployment, very good experience. And then obviously everybody knows, I think, the story afterwards. Unfortunately, some stuff ensued and ended up getting charged for war crimes, went to trial, got found not guilty of everything that I was being charged with, except for one picture. And that was it. That sort of forced my hand. I had no plans on retiring. I was definitely a 30-year guy. I loved the community. I loved the teams. That was my life. But it was also another blessing in disguise. I'm glad that going through that sort of forced me to take a step back and look at the big picture. I was married. I had three kids. And as you know, the teams will take all the time away from them. Yeah. I hadn't even looked at it in that view, up until that point, like until my wife was like, you've never been home. We've always sat, backed you, we've always been behind everything you wanted to do. You wanted to keep deploying, but this is it. Like you need to get out. And so I, listened to that and got and ended up retiring, 2019, I think the whole COVID things messed up my years, but ended up retiring 2019, and it's been sort of a whirlwind ever since, trying to figure out what to do after retirement.
Let's get into that a little bit. First of all, how long have you been married in this whole picture?
13 years. So I ended up marrying my wife. So me and my wife knew each other in high school. We were best friends.
Oh, nice.
Parted ways. When I went to join the Navy, she went to Florida to a design school. We lost track of each other. She ended up getting pregnant with a guy down there and getting married. And so after Buds and after I went to 18 Delta, I drove back through when I was going back to San Diego and stopped up in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And I just randomly called her mom to see how she was doing. And she had, I ended up talking to her. She had just recently been divorced. So we took it pretty slow, just like, hey, let's, remain friends, do the long distance thing. But after a while we knew, we're supposed to be together. So we ended up getting married before my first deployment. That was a big thing for me. I told her, if something happens to me, I want you to be taken care of in some form or fashion. So let's get married before I deploy. She's a trooper. She went headfirst into the SEAL teams, not knowing anything about it. Didn't even know what a SEAL was, really. She was a Midwest girl. She had no clue what the job entailed, and she was sort of sink or swim. And she swam. She really made something of herself in the community. She got involved with the foundations. Had a women's, Bible studies, was helping a lot of the spouses out. So she really flourished in that community, which is huge. I think that's another, it takes a very strong woman to be able to put up with the demands of NSW. And, she definitely passed the test multiple times.
Yeah. Definitely requires an independent woman that doesn't need you. Because that's what it requires. They're grateful when you're around, it's nice to have you around, but they can get by without you.
Exactly. They get their own routine, which is, I think that's what makes coming back from deployments a little bit rough, because you're trying to immerse yourself back home, and it's like, hey, the cups don't go there. They go over there. And you're like, oh, all right.
Yeah. Don't mess up the system either. That's a good lesson learned for anybody coming back. Don't mess with the system that's working without you, for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. So you learned that as well. So, coming back, you're like, I'm here. Just talking.
That's a good one. Yeah, so now you put in 20 years, 20 plus?
Yeah, 20 plus some months.
Yeah, okay, so 20 years now retired, had a unique journey compared to most of us. Looking back at it, what was it all worth it?
Oh, beyond worth it. If I could do it all over again, I would. I got to serve, and I don't think you really appreciate this until you do get out, but you see the men that you got to serve alongside, and just, I mean, you really, like, I walked amongst giants, that just true, heroes that, really just care about this country and will give anything, including their life, to defend it. That's not just, people do say that, but just, it's one thing to say it, but it's another thing to actually see someone live it out. Like,
absolutely.
That's their belief. So to me, like, there's nothing, to this day, I'm like, I don't know if I'll be able to find that again. I'm trying to, that same purpose and drive, and bring around those same kind of individuals. I wouldn't give it back. And I had, just incredible mentors in the military. They say when you join the military, you go from two parents to 50 parents. And I had, some just incredible men and women who helped me through my career, mentored me, just gave me, I am who I am today because of them. I loved it. Every minute of it.
Nice. I remember getting out, I only did 8 years, and it was, in the 90s. So it was a different world for us. How has your transition been? Going into civilian world, how's that going?
It can be rough. It's ups and downs. When I got out, obviously with all the other drama that happened, but it was still rough getting out, transitioning from this very regimented, lifestyle where I knew, I have 6 month workup, 6 month pro dev, and then deploy. You hear other people talk about it, like, oh, I can't believe, like, that schedule seems so chaotic, when really it's pretty simple. It's like, I know exactly what I'm doing all the time. I know when I'm leaving. So when you get out, that's gone. And I remember, after I think the retirement fairy dust wears off, after a couple months, you're like, okay, what am I doing now? And you're sort of pacing around the house, trying to figure it out. My wife, thank God, she's an angel. She pretty much ordered me to, she's like, you will do nothing this first year but fix yourself. I want you to get treated for all the TBI, the concussions, everything, because I had, up to that point I had multiple, which I hadn't really gotten treated while I was in. So I took all last year. That time I reached out, there's just awesome foundations. The SEAL Future Foundation really helped me out. They, as soon as I got out, they called me, they got me, appointments with doctors to check on, check my blood, check my, my brain. And then I went and did HBOT therapy through, Debbie Lee's foundation, mm-hmm. My Warriors, that helped out a lot. And then during that time, obviously COVID had hit, the lockdown. So I focused on writing the book, which was another huge, obstacle that I had overcome. And, writing a book is not easy. that wasn't an easy decision for me either, to actually agree to write a book and tell the story about what had happened in the last couple of years of my career. I had, as grown up, we're quiet professionals. You don't talk about what you do. You don't tell anybody what you do. And I still instinctively believe that, like, it was ingrained in me. When I got out and people were telling me, oh, you should write a book about what happened is a crazy story, it was very hard for me to sit down and put a, pen to paper and start talking about my career or about being a school.
A crazy story, but it deserves to be told.
Yeah, and that's, I ended up calling a couple of my buddies when I was struggling with the book, and I was like, I feel like I'm doing a disservice to the community. I feel like I'm doing this, by writing this stuff, but they all, you know, everybody was 100% like, no, you need to tell the story about what happened, because it was, it's still to this day, when I look back at it, I'm like, I cannot believe that happened. I try in the book to give the community its due, and, you know, be very, reverent about it, and, you know, just how much I love it. And, I just try to be as respectful as possible when writing it. So I hopefully, you know, when people read it, they can see that. But yeah, it was all, the writing the book was also very therapeutic for me as well.
I would bet.
To get everything out on paper. It was a process. And honestly, like, I'm glad I did it now. It's one of those things where now, just like I think when people want to go to Buds, they have that initial fear, like, oh my goodness, but then once they get there, they're like, oh, okay, this is how this works, and right. This is not as tough as I thought it was. I mean, it's tough, but it's, in my mind, I built it up to be something else. It's the same with writing a book. Once you get into it and you just start doing it, it was good. I'm glad I did it,
you know? Yeah, I imagine your wife is, I have not had an opportunity to get it, but it's not out yet, correct?
No.
So, okay, that's what I thought. Okay, so I felt bad that I hadn't read your book yet, having you on, and I was like, but I mean, your wife is involved in there a great deal. I mean, she is probably your fiercest advocate.
Oh yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, she's a pit bull for sure. Yeah. When she puts her mind to something, I believe my lawyers called her the nuclear option. They're like, okay, like, you know, there was times to talk to the media and not, but when during my whole thing, and when they needed to get a point across, they would just get her, Andrea, come here, go ahead. And she did. I mean, nothing was planned. I don't know how. She's so very articulate and so very just driven and passionate about what she believes in, that she, and it was all God, you know, and that's what got us through not only just my career, but the last 2 years. We're very faith-based. You know, I don't think that you can deal with a lot of the stuff that we see overseas, and then also the last 2 years, without giving everything to God and being like, you know, you drive me to where I need to go. This is your plan. And I think that's what gave her the strength to get through everything that we went through. But yeah, she's an amazing human being, and I feel blessed every day that I got her.
Amen. So, you know, getting out of the military, obviously there's, business that has to occur. Where are your, professional plans right now? What are you working on?
So right now we started the nonprofit called the Pipe Hitter Foundation, right after my, trial. We started, working on that to get it approved. That nonprofit, its main goal is to help active duty members, law enforcement, and service or first responders, if they are being unjustly accused or even accused of something, they have to go through the legal system. We will, you know, we'll review their case, and then we will provide legal aid. We'll raise money for their legal funds, and then also provide emergency relief funds to their family during that stressful time, because it's an immensely stressful time for everybody if you have to go through something like that.
Yeah.
And then we will also publicly advocate for you if they want it. We ask that, like, do you want us to publicly advocate, get eyes on this? We've helped a lot of SEALs so far, but, you know, of course they're like, no, I don't want to publicly advocate. And you're like, okay,
sure.
And we'll just raise money for them. That was, you know, that's one element of what we're doing. And then I'm still the business side of it. Of course, because of what had happened, I got thrown into the limelight. You know, my face was everywhere. Everybody knew who I was. So I had a lot of opportunities thrown at me when I got out that I probably wouldn't have had this not have happened. That was definitely a learning experience as well. I'm a worker, so I would say yes to everything. Oh yeah, I'll do that. But what you come to find out is not everybody has your best interests at heart. You know, that's been a sort of a learning curve as well. But we decided right now we're in the Panhandle in Florida, and we're trying to keep help out the local businesses here. So I ended up working with a gun store. It's called Precision Tactical down here. I went and met them. We created a AR built around me. I got to pick out all the parts.
Nice.
Yeah, really cool. Really awesome guys to work with. So we're selling those as well as paperweights, you know, brass knuckles. We're selling those right now. But that's sort of like a side gig. I'm really looking forward. I want to teach. I've had the opportunity to go just this last week to I was up in Virginia Beach helping Templar Medical. A bunch of guys, they pretty much teach TCCC to civilians.
Oh, nice.
I really, really enjoyed that. I felt like I was back in my niche again. So I think that's what I'm going to be focusing on the rest of this year is just, you know, training these civilians. But I think civilians are hungry to learn all this knowledge.
Such a great skill too, you know, and as an 18 Delta guy, I mean, that's perfect.
Yeah.
I know so many, you know, former Spec Ops medics that are doing TCCC. Explain real quick what TCCC is for people who may not have heard about it.
Yeah, so it's a tactical combat casualty care. It's pretty much it's the basic skills you need if you come up on, you know, somebody that's been injured, shot, or whatever, to actually, you know, treat that person and help them survive and get them to a higher level of care. Basically it's March, you know, massive bleeding, airway, respiration, circulation, hypothermia, applying a tourniquet, stopping the bleeding, all very, which seems basic stuff if you come from our community, but what you see when you're teaching these civilians, it's really opening their mind and blowing their mind, which is awesome to see. And I really do think it's an important facet that needs to be taught a lot more. I think a lot of people are focusing on, which is also good, the, you know, shooting, learning how to shoot, protect yourself, but at the same time, like, well, what's going to happen if one of your family members gets shot? You know, what are you going to do then?
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, those two go hand in hand.
Absolutely.
For sure. So it's, I got a lot out of that. I'm hoping to continue working with them as starting to do stuff here locally. But I made friends with 7th Group is down here. That's where they're based, and I've got in pretty good with them. There's a really bunch of good guys, so I'm looking to start helping them out with training, and then also teaching TCCC to civilians down here locally. So we'll see. And then also, right now the book is sort of holding a lot of that up, because DOD has the book, hasn't released it yet. So we're still waiting on that. And then once it's released, I'll have to do a book tour. That'll take up a pretty good amount of my time. But once that's done, that's my main focus, is going to go to teaching civilians, TCCC and shooting as well.
Hey, let's give Jason Higgins a little, a little shout out, just because, he's one that introduced me to you, and I've been using his Easy Day Hemp for quite some time now. In fact, I think we even have same shirts on.
No, that was not.
Yeah.
How are you liking the Easy Day Hemp?
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. You know, if you have problems going to sleep at night, and sleep is your number one recovery tool. I mean, if you're screwing up your sleep, I mean, it's just a snowball that occurs after that. So if you can nail that down, and, you know, just a squirt of that stuff, you know, an hour or so before you go to bed, I mean, it's like lights out for me, and I'm, you know, sleeping like a baby.
I found it really helps. I'll take it after a really hard workout. Helps with recovery, inflammation. I mean, I feel like 1,000 times better now after I do like really tough workouts. You know, I'm not as sore. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, he even has this cream here. I like, that makes me look like I'm still 25, right? Actually, I'm actually 52.
You don't look like it for sure.
Well, thank you. No, I just wanted to do that for Jason, because I've seen you you are involved in other products as well.
Yeah. So that's, yeah, that was also something that I, so when I got out, like we had talked about, my face had been everywhere. I was still in the limelight. My wife, Andrea, had started, while I was locked up going through all this stuff, she had started an Instagram page to sort of gain awareness of what was going on. She got a huge following. So once I got out, that she was like, well, this is sort of your Instagram page now. And I had no clue about, you know, so I'm like, what is this? You know, and I was completely against it.
Your kids can teach you everything you need to know.
They still do. Believe me, I go to them, I'm like, how do I, you know, post this?
I did the exact same thing, man. My daughter was like, Dad, you need an Instagram account. I'm like, what? I haven't even figured out Facebook yet. What do you mean I need Instagram? And
what I found out from it is it is a business model. You know, it's business. It's how people run their businesses now. And I saw a lot of veteran-owned companies, especially like Easy Day or, you know, Tribe Skates or all these guys who are starting these companies, and they're trying to help. It's still a service. They're trying to help other people. And what I learned is because of the following that my wife had accrued and that we were still going, like anytime if I post something of theirs, it really helps them out. So that's how I sort of justified with my wife. All right, we'll keep the pay. Like, I'll keep doing this if I can help these guys out. Like, that's my main motivator. So I was very lucky to link up with Jason. It's just an, you know, awesome individual.
Oh yeah.
I mean, his product it speaks for itself. You know, and then with other, you know, better known companies, I'm all about helping them out. Like, hey, you want me to post this for you? You want me to like advertise this for you?
Yep. Same. Yeah. Yep.
So it's definitely helpful in that way, for sure.
So where can people find out about more about you and your story, your book?
So you can obviously our Instagrams. My Instagram is Eddie_Gallagher. I also have we just created a website, TheEddieGallagher.com. You can go there, and that's got all of our products and everything that we're doing. And then there's also TheEddieGallagherBook.com, which we can go order the book from there. They're still up for pre-sale.
I saw if you signed up, you can review the first three chapters.
Yeah. So that's, that's
pretty cool.
Last week. Yeah. Yeah. So we're trying to give little tidbits of the book to, you know, keep people interested. DOD still has it. You know, and I've learned right when we gave it to them, I'm like, and that'll come back when it comes back. So
that, yeah.
Tactical patience. you know, they still have it, but we're trying to give people a glimpse of the book beforehand, and it's really working. You know, it's working out. I think and if people do pre-order, it comes with a challenge coin, a note from myself and Andrea, and then you will also get the book a month beforehand. Everybody else does, and it will be signed by myself and my wife.
Oh, nice! That's a nice touch.
Yeah, it's. Our publisher is really awesome. Went with a Ballast Books. Actually, Dan Luna is the one who.
Oh yeah.
Them. So, yeah, very very good publishing company. Easy to work with.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's going good.
Well, you know, any final comments? You know, about this journey that you've been on.
You know, I would say, you know, for the listeners out there, you know, a lot of the guys, if you're thinking about going to Buds, and I get asked all the time, you know, what should I do to prepare? What, you know, all these questions about trying to get there. I would say the first step is just make the decision. Like, if you're going to go, sign up, and that way you have no other option. And you don't have another excuse.
No plan B.
Nope. There's no plan B. And that's, I think that's the best route to go. And then my second piece of advice would become obsessed with it. The way I did, I mean, that's, you need to live, you know, being a SEAL even before you go to Buds, you know. And I would say the Navy SEAL fitness book that you have is, I don't see how there's any other book that you need. You know, you're not gonna, you can lift weights and do whatever. It's not going to help you when you get to Buds. you know, being a strong runner, swimmer, and having a very good core, that's what's going to help you get through, because you're going to get beat down regardless. Yeah, become obsessed with it. And, you know, these words are easier said than done, but don't quit.
Yeah.
That's it. It's just, you know, if you really want it, then stick with it and don't quit.
Well, you know, Eddie, I really appreciate you taking the time to share your experiences and your journey with us. I think it's been very valuable. Obviously you have another story that, you know, people are interested in, and if they are continue really want to be interested in, check out, you know, EddieGallagherBook.com.
Yep. And then, I've done a previous podcast. If people really want to know more about the story in intricate detail, Sean Ryan's podcast on Vigilance Elite is probably the best one, where you'll get the full story from beginning to end.
Okay, that's great. You know what? Everything that we just talked about, I'll put in the description with the links in there. So if you guys just go down into, whether it's YouTube or on the podcast places you get these, I'll put the descriptions in there for you to be able to check these out.
Awesome.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, it has been a pleasure, Eddie. I appreciate your time. Appreciate your, 20 plus years of service, and you know, keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you, brother. It's been surreal being able to talk to you. It's awesome.
All right, man. All right, everybody, check it out, and we will see you next time.
All righty.